Stonework with Pedro Liendo. Marco Mineri was here. And Suraf Sarkar. So I will start by just setting up the stage. So I'll give you a short summary of CFTs with defects to set up how we will approach this problem. And then I will tell you what is the main statement that I would like to be making of universality. And then this will be, I will first motivate it, but then it will be made more precise by inverting an OPE. And then conclusion. So what is the setup? So I am interested in CFTs in D dimensions. And then introducing defects that preserve as many symmetries as we can. So in particular, I will be introducing a p-dimensional flat defect. That breaks, of course, translations in the direction orthogonal to it, but it preserves as much as the conformal algebra as we can. Namely, it will preserve conformal transformations inside of the defect itself. And so the conformal algebra will be broken from the CFT one without defect to the defect one. So the defect has p dimensions. So this is just conformal on defect. And then there is a leftover symmetry, which is an SO d minus p. So this is basically the codimension of the defect. And this symmetry corresponds to rotations around the defect. So from the defect point of view, this looks like a global symmetry, but it comes actually from the space-time symmetry of the bulk CFT. And so this guy will actually play an important role in the talk. And as you can see, this is only present if the codimension of the defect is greater than 1. So all statements I will be making only apply to defects of codimension greater than 1, meaning that you can go around the defect. So there is this symmetry of rotations around the defect. So then in this setup, I want to start studying correlation functions. And so I can introduce bulk operators or defect operators, which are the guys I will be wanting to look at. And in particular, the statement that we will be trying to make is about some universality in the spectrum of these guys. So defect operators will be organized in representations of the preserved symmetry. And in particular, they will carry some quantum number under these rotations around the defect that I will be calling S throughout the talk. And the universality will be in the spectrum of the defect operators at large S. So this is the statement that we'll be working towards. So how are we going to make this statement? So we take the standard bootstrap approach that we want to leverage really symmetries and general consistency conditions as much as possible and maybe make a few reasonable assumptions. And you've probably heard many talks in recent years, since 10 years ago this new revival of the numerical bootstrap came in, and this kind of served as this catalyst for many different results, numerical and analytical. And what I will be telling you about today is there's no numerics, it's just some analytical statements. So we want to take this abstract viewpoint that the CFT is defined by the spectrum of all operators and all their correlation functions. So in this case, I will be having both operators in the bulk and in the defect. And then I will be interested in studying all possible correlation functions of these guys. So as I was already anticipating, on the defect, the operators should now be organized in representations of the defect conformal algebra, so they'll have some scaling dimension. And whenever it's a defect observable, I will put a hat to denote it's a defect quantum number. So they'll have some scaling dimension, some spin, but then also this quantum number of rotations around the defect. And if you have any other flavor symmetries or such, you'll have other quantum numbers. And so from the defect point of view, this is really looks like a global symmetry. So it's this one. Okay, and then on the defect, everything you know about CFTs pretty much applies. So you have an OP that, so I can erase this. So you have an OP, meaning that you can replace on defect. You can replace the product of two local operators by an infinite sum over all other operators in the theory, all other defect operators. And of course, we want to use the symmetries as much as possible, so we will organize these operators in representations of the conformal algebra. And so this sum should run over defect conformal primaries with some coefficients. And then some function that is just kinematics that basically computes for you. If you know how a primary appears, you will know how a descendant appears just by taking derivatives parallel to the defect pretty much. So this is just kinematics. And these are the things you're after, the OP coefficients and the spectrum of the operators. And the nice thing about CFTs is that, of course, this has a finite radius of convergence, so you can use it to break down endpoint functions down to one-point functions, and conformal invariance dictates that only the defect identity will have a non-zero one-point function. So pretty much all we've heard in recent years about CFTs will apply to this spectrum, to the defect operators. And the only exception is that there is no stress tensor. In particular, because the defect exchanges with the bulk, so you cannot have a conserved stress tensor on the defect itself. But from all the results we've learned in recent years, one that is particularly nice is in the spirit of universality, is showing that at large defect spin, there, if you have an operator in the defect of a given dimension, then if there exists this operator, then there are operators in the defect whose dimensions approach twice this guy plus L plus an even integer as L goes to infinity. So this was shown by Komargotki and Gboyadov, and also Fitzpatrick, Kaplan, Pollan, and Simmons Duffin. So this sort of universality at large spin in CFTs shows that any conformal field theory will have at large spin operators who look like that. And these are operators you're very familiar with if you think about free theories. These type of operators with these exact dimensions, I would just write them as something like this. Pi box to the m, and then a bunch of derivatives, phi. So these type of operators, you'd expect them in free theories. If you have a theory with a small coupling, maybe you'd expect them still to survive a little bit, but you would not expect them generically to be present in any interacting CFT. And what the statement these people made is that actually you should expect them to be present at large, asymptotically at large spin. So this is the type of universality statement that is similar to the one I will be making today. And this comes essentially from considering crossing symmetry when you take two operators to be light-like separated. And I will not give you more details of how this is shown because it is kind of similar to what I will be showing, and I will just focus on that. So this was just thinking of the defect itself and all operators that live on the defect, but of course we want to look also at operators that are in the bulk. So going back to the bulk, of course I also have still my OP that is as nice as before. The only difference now is that one-point functions will not, in the presence of the defect, they are not going to be zero, because now I have a scale. So now operators can acquire a one-point function, where the distance is now set as the distance of the operator to the defect, so orthogonal to the defect. So now this means that just knowing the OP in the bulk is not enough for you to compute any correlation function. You need an additional piece of dynamical information, which are these numbers here. All the statements that the universality statement I was making about defect operators also applies in the bulk. For large spin, you will expect this type of operators to exist. So this is all still there. But now we have a new OP channel appearing, which is when you take your bulk operator close to the defect. So this is what is studying how the bulk couples to the defect degrees of freedom. And so there is a new OP. It's a bulk to defect. So it means that if I take an operator approaching the defect, I can expand it in defect operators. And again, there will be some kinematics that one can fix. But then the interesting dynamical information are these couplings here. And in particular, the one-point function I was writing for you before, here is just a statement that if the defect identity appears, then this is just the thing I was computing here. Okay, so now this is the new information you get. And let me now make the statement, the statement I wanted to show of universality. So in this case, either without defects or on the defect itself, you were seeing that the universality that was appearing at large spin was something you knew very well. It's just the simplest CFT you could think of, a free or generalized free CFT. So here, what kind of universal defect do we know that always exists and that we would expect to satisfy whatever conditions we can derive from crossing and therefore should be responsible for this universality? So that example is the trivial defect, meaning that there is no defect at all. And all I'm doing is I imagine that there exists a defect, and I decide to break the symmetries of my CFTD into smaller symmetries, even though there is no defect there to begin with. And I just restrict to these smaller symmetries. So in this case, the defect operators are very simple. I just take a bulk operator and I evaluate it at a defect, and there is my defect operator. Now, because I insist on breaking the symmetry, derivatives on the directions of the defect produce defect descendants, so I don't care about those. But of course, derivatives orthogonal to the defect, I should think of as new defect primaries. And so I can now act with orthogonal derivatives, as many as I want. And I still have a defect primary, and I can also put boxes to some power. So this is a consistent defect. It just happens to be very simple. And these guys would have dimensions, delta hat, that are that of my bulk scalar, plus the number of orthogonal derivatives I took, including the boxes. And this S is precisely the quantum number of these rotations around the defect. So the statement that I will be making is that any defect CFT will have spectrums that asymptote to this as you take S large. So this is the universality that we will be trying to show. And how does this come about? So for this, we want to study the consistency conditions of the CFT itself. So I was writing to you various OPEs, the bulk-to-defect OPE, the OPE in the bulk, the OPE in the defect. And now for consistency, we better impose that associativity is preserved between all these different OPEs. And as always, we will translate associativity into the statement of crossing symmetry for correlation functions. So this is, in general, a very hard problem. We want to solve an infinite number of consistency conditions for an infinite number of unknowns. And this is hard. The lesson we've been learning in these recent bootstrap years is that we should try to make our problem finite in some way, so try simplifying things. So in particular, we usually consider a finite number of correlation functions, not all of them at the same time, and we'll see that we can still learn something even in this case. And then the other two keys of success have been either you find some limit that is more tractable, more solvable, or you do numerics. In this case, I will be trying to find a limit that is more minimal, that is tractable. So the simplest crossing equation you can write the minute you have defects is that of a two-point function of two bulk operators. So to simplify things, I am going to be putting this configuration where I imagine that the defect is coming out of the board, like this. And then I put the two operators on a plane that I'm parameterizing by z and z bar. I use the conformal symmetries to fix this configuration with one operator at one. And the other bulk operator can lie around in position z z bar. So this two-point function I can compute into different ways that better give me the same answer. One way is that I take this bulk operator near the defect, and I use precisely that bulk-to-defect OPE. So this correlation function, let me just strip off a kinematic prefactor in these coordinates. So now there are two ways to compute this G. One is expansion in defect operators, so delta hat and S, with some OP coefficients, and then some that are basically the square of these guys I was writing here. And then a conformal block that keeps track of all descendants. If you know how primary appears, this just computes for you how all descendants will appear. It's purely kinematics, and it has been computed by Marco, Edo, and collaborators. And there's another way I can compute the exact same correlation function, which is instead to take the OP between the two bulk operators. And this should give me the same answer. So I will write crossing symmetry for you here. So now I'm using the bulk OP between these two guys. Then I get a bunch of bulk operators, and I'm just evaluating their one-point function in the presence of the defect. So this is the three-point coupling. And now the one-point function appears with some block that was also computed. And this was the defect. Okay, so now how can we take some simplifying limits of these two equations? So there are two limits one can think of. One is I will want to take the two bulk operators to become to go on each other's light cone, but without going on top of each other. So I don't want to be taking the bulk OP. I want to now continue from an Euclidean configuration into a Lorentzian one, where I can actually make the distance between them going to zero with them, without them actually going on top of each other. So I make this guy go on this light cone. So I want to take z bar to 1. So this was at 1, 1 at fixed z. Then, in this OP channel, the bulk OP is converging very nicely, and you can see that what dominates in this OP are low twists in the bulk. So, in this limit, this OP is becoming suppressed by the twist of the operator. The leading contribution is the identity operator that will appear, followed by the stress tensor and all other low twist operators. But it's a nice calculable limit. The defect OP, however, is stopping to converge because of where I'm going. And actually, by studying precisely this crossing equation and seeing how this OP is stopping to converge, you can see that what is responsible for this non-convergence is the sum over spin. And you will infer that there must exist defect operators with large S and whose dimensions go precisely to delta O plus S plus 2M. So this is the limit I will be focusing on today, and I will be showing this statement not through this crossing equation in the light cone, but through inverting this defect OP. Let me just briefly comment that there is another natural light cone limit you can take, which is instead to consider maybe a different color, to consider the bulk operator becoming light-like separated from the defect. So this is z to 0 at fixed z bar. And in this case, this OP is still converging nicely, and this one is being dominated by low defect, low transverse twist, by which I mean low delta hat minus S. This is not as nice as this one, for the reason that S is not really part of the defect conformal algebra. This is some global symmetry from the defect point of view. And so there is no unitarity bound that tells me that this thing is bounded from below even, or that there should be a gap in this twist spectrum. But these are the things that dominate. And then if you assume that there is such a gap and that the leading contribution is the defect identity, that will have delta hat equals zero and s equals zero, then you can do the reverse. And in this case, it will be large bulk spin that is responsible for the non-convergence of this OP, and the statement you will be making, you would be finding that these double twist operators, the universal sector of the bulk OP, of the bulk CFT, would have to acquire a one-point function. But this will come at the cost of this type of assumption that in the defect CFT we generically don't know. So I will focus on the other limit where things are nice and bulk unitarity suppresses this. There is a twist gap and everything can be made nicely. So okay, so how are we going to establish this result? Okay, the way historically this happened in the bulk was precisely this. We were just studying this crossing equation in this limit and trying to infer how the density of operators for large S should grow like, how these OP coefficients should grow like to be able to reproduce the behavior on this side. But since the work of Karen Poe, this has been done differently by the means of inversion formulas. So this is precisely what we will go for now. And I will quickly review the inversion formula and then show you how to recover precisely this result. So what is an inversion formula? So the idea is that we want to invert the defect OPE. So inverting meaning what? Meaning that we have this decomposition in defect blocks, and I want to find, I want to integrate this correlation function against some kernel. To extract a function that depends on the, basically I want to extract these OP coefficients, and the way I'm doing so is I'm extracting some function that depends on the defect scaling dimension and this orthogonal spin, such that this function has poles precisely where all my defect operators are. So it should have poles for each defect operator that exists in this OP. In delta hat, and the residue is proportional to the OP coefficient of that operator that I was writing there. So O phi hat. For this is for fixed integer S. So this sounds something very boring and trivial. If you just give me the two-point function, I can decompose it in blocks and I read off all these numbers. I'm just telling you that instead I can write some integral equation that extracts the same information. So this would be an Euclidean inversion formula. It's just a boring way of extracting from the correlator the same information you could have extracted anyway. So now the trick comes when you want to start from this inversion formula that was integrating in a Euclidean configuration and continue to Lorentzian and get something where we can get more information. So in this case, in particular, you need to know the whole two-point function to be able to extract this information. There's no simplifying thing you could take. If you know it all, you can extract this information, which is really not what I want. The other one should be something that gives me a way to probe precisely this type of limit, that somehow knowing something about the low twist in the bulk OP should still suffice to learn something about the defect spectrum without needing to know everything about the CFT. And this would allow us to make universal statements. So I shouldn't erase the picture. So here, the defect was coming out. I was in a Euclidean configuration, and so Z and Z bar were complex conjugates. And I will write them as some radius times some phase that I'm already calling W. So W is just some phase. So this would be the Euclidean scenario where W and W, W is just a phase. And the trick now comes from starting from this integral and trying to massage it in a way that first, this integral only makes sense for integer s. I would like to have it make sense for any s, so to have some function that is analytic in s. And doing so by massaging the integral and moving away from this Euclidean region to a Lorentzian one. So let me, if I draw here this W plane, we were integrating on the unit circle. And now there is here a cut that starts at the bulk OP. Here as well, the image. And now the idea is that we want to deform this contour from going around this circle and pulling it down like this. And so this is a technical point that I'm making just to show you one important step in going between these two inversions, the Euclidean one and the Lorentzian that I will be writing down. That is, when you're doing this type of manipulations, you want to end up with an integral around this region, and so you'll be dropping some arcs. And this dropping of the arcs you cannot do in general. If you're familiar with the four-point function case, it's boundedness in the Reggie limit that allows you to show that you can drop these arcs for all spins greater than one. In the defect case, we could not bound how the correlation function grows in this limit. So here there is one crucial assumption that will go in, which is we assume G is bounded like this. So it grows less than some power of W as W goes to infinity. Or to zero in this case, the way I wrote it. And so this will tell you that you are allowed to drop, if this S is finite, this will tell you that you're allowed to drop these arcs, and so the formula I'm writing down is valid for all S greater than S star. Okay, so then what we get is some inversion formula that now is manifestly analytic in the spin. I won't write the precise inversion formula because it's a messy function, but it's basically, again, the green integral of some kernel. But now with these contour manipulations, we picked up a discontinuity of G across this cut that I just erased. And so the fact that this is now analytic in S means that you can take this function to be this inversion to be valid not just at integer S, but it makes sense continuing in S. And you can now ask directly what happens at large S. So at large S, I can take large S here and here and see what happens to this integral. And you will find that this integral is localizing. It's being dominated by So at large S, the kernel is projecting the integral to a region dominated by z bar to 1. This is precisely the Lightcon limit I started to tell you about. So if you want to know stuff about large S, the kernel projects you to this region where z bar goes to 1, and I know how to represent my correlation function nicely as z bar goes to 1, because as I told you before, only low bulk twists dominate. So in this way, if you take large S, the integral is dominated by the lowest, so hence low bulk twist dominates. And so you can just start plugging in. You know the bulk identity appears. You plug it in, and you get precisely this accumulation point that I started by making the statement of. So you get so bulk identity. You find that you will have operators of dimension delta hat that approaches S plus delta O, the bulk external operator I'm considering, plus 2m. Then you want to add the next leading bulk twist, which is the stress tensor. And you can compute a correction to this formula. So you get some number over S to the tau m, where this is the twist of the leading operator of the identity, which usually is the stress tensor. And you can set up some sort of perturbation theory, but you can actually do a bit more because you have the whole inversion, so you can invert the whole block and have some sort of resum perturbation theory. So apart from these universal statements that you can make about any defect spectrum just by universal statement in the bulk, the other nice application of such a formula is that it is very nice if few operators contribute on this right-hand side, because then I get to learn something. I get to learn the left-hand side by little information. This happens often in perturbative settings and so on. So if you have finitely many bulk blocks contribute to this continuity, then you can get some mileage out of this. And we give a few examples in the paper. So to finish, I've been showing you this universality in the defect spectrum, and I consider this, this comes from this particular Lightcon limit where you take the two bulk operators being like separated. Of course, I started by mentioning that there's another limit, so a natural thing one would like to do, and it has actually been done now, is to do the other inversion, invert instead the bulk OP, where you can plug in stuff about the defect. So in this case, because of maps between bulk blocks and four-dimensional blocks, you can actually get a lot out of just by starting from Caron-Woese four-point function inversion. And so the Andulink and Chomerus have now obtained a bulk inversion formula. That the idea is again the same. Now you would get the information about one-point functions times OP coefficients in terms of some integral kernel. And now again, similar to the bulk, to the four-point function case, you actually get a double discontinuity of the correlator. Now, a nice thing that we've been looking at is that the double discontinuity is positive now, as opposed to the discontinuity that was not, even though you were actually getting positive defect OP coefficients. This was not entirely guaranteed from this exact formula because there's a discontinuity which is not positive. But in this case, the double discontinuity is positive. And on this side, you have something that is not you wouldn't expect a particular sign. And so with Marco and Lorenzo, we've been looking at this in the sense that it, similarly to how you've shown that the leading Reggie trajectory is convex, Nachman's theorem, you should be able to use positivity of the double discontinuity to show that the leading Reggie trajectory has a definite sign for this product. And then, okay, having two inversions now opens up the door to do all sorts of things, like what was done by David Simon-Zaffin for the 3D easing model, where you can make some limited assumptions about the CFT data, and then plug it in these inversions, and so how close this is to the actual information you want to compute. Okay, I will stop here. Thank you.
So can you use these relations to somehow input the arc spectrum in the boost of four-point functions on the defect?
You want to input the bulk spectrum?
I mean, suppose I try to bootstrap on the defect, four-point function of defect operator. Can you use this relation to somehow add in information about the bulk?
Yes, if you know information about the... So I guess you would like to then do on top of this the defect four-point function inversion, something like that. So
or even numerically,
or even numerical
bootstrap with this asymptotic.
How to plug in? Okay. Also in the four-point function case, this is a. What you would be saying is something like, I know a little bit about this left-hand side, like the leading twist. I plug it in and I get some. I have an approximation for my spectrum for large spin. And now can I plug in this large spin spectrum in my numerics? This is something that would be interesting to do. You would, of course, be losing some of the rigor that makes the numerics nice, right? Because now you're giving it, you'd have to give it this CFT data with some error, and only for large spin, so you'd try to impose some. I think it's an interesting game to play, but keeping in mind that we will be losing the fact that numerics usually gives you true bounds. Now you're playing some more hybrid game where you're kind of losing control over the errors. But this is also similar to what has been played where you don't even do numerics, or you just, the other direction is more direct. You do your numerics, you know a little bit of flow twist, you plug it in the inversion and you get approximate answers. And then you take these approximate answers, you believe in them, you plug it in the other inversion, you get some approximate answers for the thing you started with, and you compare and see how they do. And this is what basically David Simon-Zaffin did for the 3D easing model, and it works very nicely. So this is something one would like to play also in a defect scenario.
Do you know what this S star is, certain example? Or?
Yes, I didn't say that, but yeah, we did check these S bars in all the examples we could basically get our hands on, and it's always like 0 or 1. So it, in all examples we know, the formula converges down to some low finite spin. And in general, there is no reason to believe why it shouldn't be suppressed like this, right? Why should it grow faster than... So as long as there's some power-like suppression, then you would be good. But in examples, it seems to always work, yes.
Just a naive question. Do you have any idea of how to make progress on two-dimension one case?
Well, Codimension 1 would have been your talk if you had given it. So all we did really relied very heavily on these rotations around the defect. So all we see, the bulk of this inversion was really continuing in this other direction. So this is not there for the boundary. So all we've said doesn't apply. But the talk you would have given, I guess, would be answering that question. I don't know if you want to say something.
That's right. So we don't have this additional spin problem in the boundary.
that's right. So you don't have this additional spin parameter in the boundary case. Nevertheless, you can play similar games to the one that were played for the four-point function in CFP1. And so there is a story about extracting a little functionals that are adapted into theory. And there's also some sort of an analog of the Lorentzian inversion formula, the one for boundary theory. In the paper by Dalimil, Shinan, and me from last December, and I'll have to talk more about it.
Last one. So is there any connection to the C boundary C theorem? So can you construct anomalies using these B factors?
The connection to what?
With C theorem. Boundary or G theorem.
So now you're thinking about RG flows.
I'm interested in RG flows, so that...
Not the direct connection that I can. I mean, everything we've said really relies on conformal symmetry, so it only be true on the conformal point.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know of any direct connection that would.
But still, you destroy the conformal symmetry, right, by the de facto.
Yes. So we could say something about the starting point and the ending point, but it's not clear how to connect them along the way.
Mm-hmm. So maybe.
Okay, so let's thank Madeline.